You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
If you remember last week, we were studying the Ten Commandments, and we all became acutely aware of the fact that we break these constantly. I've taught on this several times. I've also taught on Jesus' commentary on the Ten Commandments. And people say, whoa, man, I'm feeling kind of like bad after I read this. I'm like, yeah, how do you think I feel? I'm teaching and trying to measure up the Ten Commandments very hard. That's the point. The point is to show just how far short we fall from a perfect, morally flawless God. And this really raises the question at this juncture in the book, how is it that morally flawed people like ourselves are able to come into the presence of a just, morally flawless being like God? Once you get past Exodus 20, you need to pause and rethink your life, because we're dealing with a God that is utterly holy, totally different, totally distinct, morally perfect. What do we need? We need a tabernacle. And that's where we pick up here in Exodus 25 through 28. I'm not going to read it all, but I'm going to try and bring this all together in kind of a systematic sort of way. Let's pick up in Exodus chapter 25, verse 1. The Lord said to Moses, "Tell the Israelites to bring me an offering. You are to receive the offering from me, from everyone whose heart prompts them to give. God loves a cheerful giver." Elsewhere, we see that they had to bring their tithe. With this is voluntary. They get to chip in if they want. These are the offerings that you are to receive from them. Gold, silver, and bronze. These are where the nomadic people, slaves, get gold. Egypt. Remember, they pilfered it right before they left. So they could use this gold to build the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant. "Then I have to make a sanctuary for me, and I will dwell among them. Make this tabernacle and furniture exactly like the pattern I will show you." So apparently, and we get this from the letter to the Hebrews in the New Testament, God showed Moses this whole picture. When he had him up on the mountain, Mount Sinai, for 40 days, he could literally see some kind of a figure of what all this looked like, and God gave him the exact dimensions for everything that we're about to read. There's a play on words here in the Hebrew that is interesting. The word for dwell and the word for tabernacle come from the same root. So maybe to give a better translation, if I dare, if you want to dwell with me, you need a dwelling. So how do we get close with God? You need a tabernacle. If you want to get close, you got to come through a tabernacle, or a temple is another way of thinking about this. And it needs to be specified. And it is arduous to get through these chapters. Exodus 25, and then you think you're done, 40 verses. And then Exodus 26, and now we're going to talk about the showbread. Exodus 27, and then the priest, and you need the showbread. It needs to have two columns and six in each column, and it's just like, what is all this? And this needs to be 27 inches and 42 inches and 15 feet wide and 10 feet tall. On and on, over and over, for four chapters. Then you think you're done, and it just keeps on going. It gets into the laver and the washings and the ablutions and the way that the priest can come into this tabernacle, exactly like the pattern I will show you. We could think of the tabernacle, we don't precisely know what it looked like, but it was some sort of a tent within which we have all of these different commodities. And when you think about this, most religions on planet Earth, ancient or modern, believe in tabernacles or temples, mostly temples. I'm saying most, if not virtually all. You study comparative religion, one of the things you see very quickly, very, very quickly, Western religions, Eastern religions, that if you want to get into contact with God or the gods or the all or the other, you don't just walk into he, she, it, they's presence. You need to come through a temple. Temples are, it's hard to explain to a Western postmodern thinker, but it's almost like a nexus, a crossroads where we're in the natural realm, the physical realm, but God's in the transcendent spiritual realm. And these two don't mix. It's like oil and water. And How do you get into contact with the transcendent and the immanent, the supernatural divine with the human? You can't. So whether it's the other or the all or the gods or God, there's just no way to do that. Unless you come through a temple. A temple is almost like a nexus where you get to come into the room and God goes into that room and you get to meet with God inside of a temple. Very, very strange to modern ears. For us, we think that God is either so remote that we have utter and total freedom, we can do whatever we want, or that God is so imminent, so close to us, of course he would want to get together with somebody like me, baby, right? He's looking for somebody like me to talk to, and God is lovey-dovey, and he's like a warm quilted blanket fresh out of the dryer, and that's the way God is he's close and he's warm and he's fuzzy, and that's the way we think about God. I hope I can just impress upon you, if that's your view, I hope I can impress upon you the fact that most people don't think the way you do. Most people on earth have never thought that way. They think that God is separate. And in order to come into his presence, you need, I don't know how to describe this. The best way I could describe it in modern terms is from that film, Interstellar. Maybe some of you have seen it, where they're trying to get from point A to point B. And they need a wormhole. Hey, heck, I brought a clip. Why don't we watch a little section from it? What do you think? All right, let's check it out.
That's it. That's the wormhole.
Say, don't spread it around. It's a sphere. Of course it is what you thought it would just be a hole. I'm not sure how it works. So they say you want to go from here to there. But it's too far, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a wormhole bends space like this. So you can take a shortcut through. Higher dimension. But who put it there? Who do we have to thank?
I'm not thanking anybody until we get out of here in one piece, Ron.
You'll have to watch the rest of it on your own time. But I hope that impresses upon you the point that to get from one part of the galaxy to the other, you don't just travel that insurmountable distance. You need a wormhole. You need hyperdrive. You need something to be able to do that. How do we get from one dimension, the natural realm, into the transcendent realm? Temple. You need a temple. You need a way that God has set up for us to come into his presence. And inside the Jewish tabernacle, which later became the temple under Solomon, about 400 years later, we see all of these different aspects of furniture and people that were allowed to go in and people that weren't. For example, we have the bread of presence. This was bread that was baked before the Lord. Only the priests could eat it, normally. There's some exceptions, 1 Samuel 21. The altar of incense, which represents the prayers of the people. The golden lampstand, in Hebrew it's called the menorah. This was, think about that picture. You've got leather all outside of this temple, and inside it's pitch black, and you got this menorah lighting up the inside of the temple, or tabernacle. As we get further in, just to get into the tabernacle itself, the high priest and the priest needed to wash their hands, Exodus 30. It says if they didn't, that they would die. Then they come in, they light the menorah, the bread, the incense. But then you got another compartment within the... So this is already exclusive. What is this saying? Do not enter. That's what it's saying. God is saying, you're separate from me. Isaiah 59:2. Your sins have made a separation between us. So we're just getting past the first part. It's like going through the TSA to get into the airport. You know, we got through the first part. Now there's an entire second part, which is referred to as the Holy of Holies. To get in there, you see how there's that second temple or a second veil only one guy is allowed to go in there, the high priest. And inside of that is the Ark of the Covenant. High priest, only one. On the Day of Atonement. So what are we seeing here? One man, once a year. That's all. Wait a minute. You're saying in the Holy of Holies, that's where God dwells. Yes. And one guy, once a year, gets to go in there. And he would, quote, carry the names of the sons of Israel in the breast piece of judgment over his heart. That imagery, one guy is carrying the names of the people into the presence of God. He would, quote, bear the guilt involved in the sacred gifts the Israelites consecrate. They would be acceptable to the Lord. He's standing in for the people to come into God's presence. Not just anybody could go in. Just the high priest could go in. Then we have the Ark of the Covenant. What's he doing in there? He's just milling around in there? No. You got this box in there called the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant has, according to Exodus 25, verse 17, this golden lid. It says, make an atonement cover of pure gold, 2.5 cubits long and 1.5 cubits wide. A cubit is 18 inches, so 4x2-ish. But this needed to be exact on their measurements, that's for sure. Gold on the top, pure gold. And make 2 cherubim. Ever heard of a cherub? Angel. Cherubim, plural. 2 cherubim out of hammered gold at the ends of the cover. Make 1 cherub on one end and the 2nd cherub on the other. Make the cherubim of 1 piece with the cover at the 2 ends. The cherubim are to have their wings spread upward, overshadowing the cover with them. The cherubim are to face each other, looking down at the cover, this atonement cover. The cherubim are looking at the top of the Ark of the Covenant, looking down at it. Okay, what's that about? Well, what are they looking at? That could probably help us a little bit. Within the Ark of the Covenant, we know that there are at least 3 things. At least only 3 things are mentioned in the Old Testament. We have, for one, the leadership of God being symbolized by Aaron's staff. Firstly, we have Aaron's staff, which, if you've read Numbers 16 and 17, you know that at one point, this whole cabal of rebels was trying to rise up against Aaron and Moses, and they were trying to take him out. Why do you get to lead? You're old. You know, we want to have a shot. You always get to call the shots around here. Korah's rebellion. And God says, all right, you all pull out your staffs, and tomorrow, if one of them buds, almond blossoms, that's the one whom I have picked. Sure enough, Aaron's rod blossoms, the others don't, and they get swallowed up in the earth. You should read it for yourself. God is basically declaring, I'm with him, not with them. He says, I want you to take that staff. I want you to put it inside the Ark of the Covenant. Numbers 17:10. Put back Aaron's staff in front of the Ark of the Covenant of the law to be kept as a sign to the rebellious. Number 2, we have the manna was placed in there. You remember this, Exodus chapter 16. Remember with all their grumbling? They had this perfectly nutritious food. And it was brought in to the people. They had as much as they needed. And yet they were grumbling. They're saying in the worst act of dark comedy ever, man, we really want the meat back in Egypt. I know the slavery and the totalitarian rulership and the infanticide, that was bad. But the meat was really good, wasn't it? And they're grumbling at God. And God is like, well, I want you to take a jar and fill it with about 1/2 gallon of that manna. Okay, and then what? Aaron did just as the Lord had commanded to Moses. And he eventually placed it into the Ark of the Covenant. What does this symbolize? They rejected God's provision, the manna from heaven. Thirdly, God's 10 commandments were placed inside the Ark. We read in Deuteronomy 10:5, as well as Exodus 25, I placed the tablets in the Ark of the Covenant, which I had made, just as the Lord had commanded me. And the tablets are still there in the Ark. So what's this image here? We got God's leadership being symbolized. We got God's provision being symbolized and God's character being symbolized and the angels. And according to the scriptures, there are myriads upon myriads of angels. You know what a myriad is, right? 10,000. 10,000 times 10,000. 100 million. But then it says myriads, plural. There's got to be billions of angels, whole species of angels, with God in heaven, looking down at these relatively advanced primates, you know? They're hairy and they're upright and they have opposable thumbs. And for some reason, God really loves these people. They don't know why, but God says it. He gave them the dominion of the entire world and made them in his own image and loves them. We don't know why, but look at them. I mean, look at them. They've thrown off God's leadership. Guilty. Guilty as charged. Guilty as anything. They've thrown off God's provision for them and they've grumbled about it. Guilty. Totally guilty. And worse than that, they've rejected God's own character. Guilty. 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 And you know, the angels, they've got to be looking at this, saying, you hate to see it. You hate to see it. But they're going to get it, aren't they? I mean, you can't just snub God. You can't just thumb your nose at God and expect nothing is going to happen. This is the God of the Ten Commandments. This is a holy God, a distinct God, a morally flawless, a just God, a God of judgment. And they've completely thrown off everything that God has offered them. What's the solution? An innocent animal was brought in by the high priest once a year on the day of Yom Kippur. Yom means day. Kippur means ransom or atonement. So Yom Kippur is the day of atonement. And the high priest would kill a bull or a goat or a lamb and would bring that blood into the Holy of Holies. And he would bring it up onto the Ark of the Covenant. And we read in Exodus, or rather Leviticus 16, verse 15, Aaron, the high priest, must slaughter the first goat as a sin offering for the people and carry its blood behind the inner curtain, the Holy of Holies. There he will sprinkle the goat's blood over the atonement cover and in front of it, just as he did with the bull's blood. Why? What's with this deal with the blood? Keep reading. Leviticus 17, 11. The life of a creature is in the blood. I have given it to you to Kippur. Make atonement for yourselves on the altar. On the Ark of the Covenant, you're going to make atonement right there at the mercy seat, the atonement cover. It is the blood that makes atonement for one's life. So here we have the angels looking down at humanity just saying they've got to be able to come under justice. They have to. God has to judge these people. Yet, we have a priest come into God's presence with the bloody animal. And then that blood is smeared, I mean, sprayed, lathered, all over the top of the altar. So now, what is it that the angels see when they're looking down in this entire divine drama, looking down from heaven? What do they see? Do they see the rejection of God's provision? Or do they see the revulsion against God's perfect character? Do they see the throwing off of God's leadership? No. They only see the blood of the Lamb. And so the angels, instead of being disgusted at the human race, they see something different. A covering, an atonement, a ransom, a payment is made for these wicked, sinful people. I'm speaking, of course, of us. And so we have here a picture for people who in the ancient world were just as smart as you or I. However, they weren't literate. Many of them, most of them were slaves. They didn't know how to read. So how could they understand deep things like God's forgiveness and love? This is how. This drama was laid out once a year, every year. Where this entire thing, we're talking about thousands of gallons of blood. What was it all for? Jesus. So that when Jesus of Nazareth came on the scene in AD 33, and he died on that cross in April of AD 33, Jesus fulfilled this entire picture. For one, Jesus is God in human flesh. He is truly God and truly human. So we can read in John 1:14, when John's trying to describe what Jesus is like, he says, in the beginning was the Word, and The Word was with God, and the Word was God, and He was in the beginning with God. And all things were made through Him. Apart from Him, nothing was made that was made. And yet in verse 14 we read, and the Word, that incredible, powerful Logos, the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. It makes you wonder. You know, all religions have a temple because all religions have holy space, a sanctus, a sanctuary. That's the holy spot over there. God is just like, forget that. Okay, we don't need that. I'm going to have a tabernacle. It's a mobile home, and I'm going to take it wherever I go, and wherever I go, you follow. Totally, totally strange for world religion. World religion is all about this is the spot that's holy. And God says, no, no, no. Wherever I go is the holy place. Jesus coming in flesh exemplifies this, the transcendent God coming and putting on the body of a human being to the utmost degree. We can't even put that to words, what that must have been like to give up the utility, the prerogatives of deity to take up the body of humanity. The perfect tabernacle, the perfect example of God living among us. He identifies with us as the perfect priest. These other priests, they were not perfect. They could come into the presence of God, but they knew they had sin. Why all the washings? Why all the cleaning? Why all the prayers and preparation and the lighting of the menorah and the incense and the burning and the only once a year? What's that communicate? Over and over and over and over for 1,400 years. To see that happen over and over, what's it communicating? It's like brushing your teeth. If you brush your teeth once, it's not once for all. You got to keep doing it. Why? Because the gingivitis keeps coming back, all right? So the problem's not solved just because you do it once. You got to keep doing it over and over because the problem keeps reappearing. But Jesus enters the holy place with his death on the cross once for all. Once he dies on the cross, it's over. The sin problem is over. The alienation is through. He intercedes as the sinless priest. Not only was his work perfect, but he was perfect. He could enter into God's presence as a sinless person. He's the only person of whom it could be said he is flawless, morally speaking. I've read atheistic websites. Show me the best arguments of Jesus sinning. Oh, it is laugh out loud funny. You can't get Jesus for anything. You can't nail him with anything. Sinless. And he comes into the presence of God to be the priest that we never had. He's also the perfect sacrifice. The perfect sacrifice. So the perfect tabernacle, the perfect priest, and also the sacrifice within that tabernacle from that. He's all three. Tabernacle, priest, and sacrifice. He comes into God's presence. And instead of a lamb, what would a lamb's death do? I can't do anything. How could a lamb's death pay for something that you did? You're a free moral agent. A bull dies in your place. A goat dies for your sins. No, but all these animals could point toward the fact that there's someone coming who actually can. And Jesus, being fully God and fully man, could die in our place so that he could identify with us as sinners. But he could also pay for all the sins of humanity. Think about that. 100 billion humans? I don't know how many there have ever been. 100 billion humans and paying for their eternal separation from God. How do you do that in 3 hours on a cross? Only if you're truly God. So he's all three, and this entire picture describes Jesus. Let's leave off here. Mark 15th chapter, verse 37, Jesus uttered another loud cry and he breathed his last. He gave up his life. At that moment, the curtain in the sanctuary of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. You know, the curtain. The curtain that cordons off the holy space. The curtain that says, do not enter. The curtain that says, one man, once a year. The curtain that says, don't you dare come into God's presence your own way, through works, through your own right. The curtain that says, stop here or else. That at the moment Jesus gives up his final breath and he dies, that curtain is toast. And the way into the holy place is split wide open. What a picture. Now this entire thing has been fulfilled. No longer needed. Do we need a tabernacle anymore? Do we need a priest? Do we need a sacrifice anymore? Answer, yes, we do. Yes, we do. But only one will do. Not going to a human priest, not going to a holy place, not sacrificing and sacrificing and giving more and more and more and more. That's religion. That's what religion says. Jesus says, I am the priest. I am the sacrifice. I am the holy place. And the way that we come to God is through him. So we can read, for example, in Hebrews chapter 9, verse 11, Christ has now become our high priest. He entered that greater, more perfect tabernacle in heaven, which wasn't made by human hands, and it's not part of this created world. With his own blood, he entered the most holy place once for all time and secured our redemption forever. Have you ever heard that before? Many people have never heard this. They hear this and they say, that cannot be right. That cannot be true. What about going to the priest? What about going to the holy place? What about sacrificing? What about becoming a better person? This is the solution to the Ten Commandments. Don't you see that? Jesus came to fulfill everything that we couldn't. God sent his son for everything that we couldn't do. He gave his son so that we could become his sons. The only issue before you tonight, if you're hearing that for the first time, is will you accept it? God's not asking you to sacrifice. He's not asking you to work. What he's asking you to do is say, I'm finished working. I'm finished with religion. I'm finished trying to strive toward you. Instead, I just want to accept the way that you traveled and made your way toward me. And I just want to accept that gift. When you do that, that's a prayer that God always answers. When you pray and say, I want to have the forgiveness of Jesus in my life, God says, yes, every time. So if you pray that, you can know for sure. On God's end, he's just standing there saying, I'm ready to take you. I want to know you. The only question is for you, are you willing to reach out to him in prayer?
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.